This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 floating away into space on a balloon with the name Kenny on it here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Felisco. Maybe the greatest introduction we've had so far. And that's
well, amazing. This is the best Kenny we've done thus far.
I was thinking that he's the best Kenny, right?
He's number one Kenny without question. I really like this Kenny. He's a good Kenny. He's the best Kenny I've ever seen on film. Esther Zuckerman, thank you for joining us.
Hello.
Always a pleasure. We love catching rats with you.
we do.
I don't know why I waved because me wave.
Our patrons. Yes.
So when I reached out to Esther about this, you mentioned that you had not seen it. So the three of us were watching this all for the first time. Yes. I reached out because I just had a feeling that maybe you were a Lynn Ramsey person. No judgment, you know, whatever. But well, because I mean, she's tough, man.
She's tough. Yeah.
It's not even so much that like her stuff is very sort of esoteric and very kind of a vibe and visual filmmaking and all of that stuff, but she's also like, they're all rough rides. Like they're none of them are fun either. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, a Terrence Malick, for instance, where like, you know,
it's a rip roaring time.
No, but Malick
laughing and like, dancing. And
but his stuff is more dreamlike. His stuff has a lot more sort of like there's I'm not saying he's not talking about heavy issues. I think
Malick's movies are vaguely optimistic.
They're
they have that sort of religious tint to it too. Yeah, sort of faith like.
Yeah, even the bad, like even like, I mean, I think my favorite Malick film really is Badlands, which I think is like super romantic and like really kind of this lovely. But it's also about, you know, teenage murderers. So like,
it's true. I mean, the movie that I thought of kind of the most as I was watching this was George Washington. The David Gordon Green movie.
Yeah, I love George Washington.
I've never seen George Washington.
Good movie. Good movie. Very good movie. And I mean, you ultimately would kind of never know based on the career that David Gordon Green has created for himself.
I love his whatever he has done.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's crazy. Also, I'm not sure if you guys have seen it yet, but in Bones and All, the Luca Guadagnino movie out this year, there is a scene where David Gordon Green pops up as an actor playing the most upsetting man like ever on the planet alongside Michael Stuhlbarg giving a insanely creepy performance. And you're like, hold on a second, is that David Gordon Green? It's so weird.
To see it.
And then he also made Halloween Ends this year. So
he's made so many.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Or like, you know, Let's Get Stoned in the Middle Ages. Yes, that's what it was called. There are very few art house directors I was in on from the ground floor, but I was in on David Gordon Green from the ground floor in that I saw George Washington. I don't know when it came out, but I watched it in college like often.
It was a movie that for, I want to say,
late, I think later, yeah. I think later, maybe even like maybe 2000. But for whatever reason, it was a movie that a friend of mine had gotten really into and played a lot. We played it a lot. And this is not the best thing to say at this point, but it was almost Liz Farian in that when he started to do his mainstream stuff, you're like, what is going on? You're not supposed to be on the radio. You're not supposed to be doing like dumbass stoner movies. And I think now it's weird to talk about David Gordon Green and Lynn Ramsey and stuff, but I think now he has such a wild breadth of what he's done in three Halloween movies. He'd be a really interesting kind of, you know, filmography to tackle from the top.
Blank check, interesting.
If he's had one.
But he's not. He hasn't had that. Like, I saw somebody tweet and I can't credit who it was, but like the idea of the journeyman director has like gone so by the wayside, and he's sort of that though. Like,
it might have been
does
me.
Like I can't remember what.
So I've been talking a lot about that him. Too. No, I think about that. Too.
Maybe it was you. I don't know. Somebody said that. So, like, but maybe he's like truly that person now. Because I was like, I know we're getting so off topic, but I just was like, like, what was the sort of like path before? And it was like, Stronger, which is the Boston Marathon survivor movie, which is very good.
Yeah.
Our Brand is Crisis, which is not very good.
It like, doesn't exist.
Yeah, that movie doesn't exist. Like Joe, which is an interesting, it's just so, but that, and that was like, he went back to Joe after doing like the whole run of like Pineapple Express and Your Highness.
Yeah.
And like, it's so strange. Like,
What was the one you just said?
The Sitter, a movie that doesn't exist as well.
The Sitter, the Jonah Hill movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
He has this one for them lane with the Goldberg crowd. And then obviously, you know, is his Danny McBride stuff that I think they go back 40 years or whatever. But
he's in All the Real Girls. He's like an actor.
Yes, he is. Yeah. I think that, it's like they went to college together, but I think, if he had a blank check moment, because I just watched the first of this run of Halloween this week and I was really, first I was surprised how much I loved it, and I loved it. But what I'm really surprised is that it made $300 million off a $10 million budget. So this guy, it's crazy. Yeah. So this guy does kind of have one to cash in ready to go, I think.
I'm beginning to wonder if the fucking Exorcist is his blank check.
Oh yeah, I forgot that's what he's doing.
Like he's doing
really?
Yeah, oh my God, why am I drawing a blank on her name? Who is
George C. Scott.
No, not George.
Oh no, he was only in the third one. Sorry,
Ellen Burstyn. Thank you. Yeah, she's going to be in this, which is a bit of a blank check to some degree, but it's a blank check to like start another franchise.
Doing the same thing,
So
Halloween Ends, by the way, not to keep us full off track, Halloween Ends is bananas and I think fun.
I gotta watch.
I'm only watching these new ones because I wanted to run the series this Halloween. It's a lot of work. I went right to the new ones because I'm watching with my son, and I went right to the new ones only because the way people are talking about Halloween Ends is too exciting. It's too exciting for me. Like the
Billy Ray.
Billy Ray is the only, I mean, God love him. Bill Murray is the only person I respect who hates these movies. Everyone else I respect is like, this movie. Everyone else I respect is like, it rocks. It's like Twin Peaks. What? Okay, really? Cool.
All right.
The second, I did not like the second one. I think the third one is so fun and like off the rails. It's just off the rails.
I need off the rails with this franchise.
Speaking of off the rails, to get us a little back on the
rails. Get back on the rails. Get us back on the rails.
I'll just say that the reason I brought it up, the reason George Washington came into my mind as I was watching it is because, again, it's very much told from a sort of a childlike perspective of a sort of plotless, I don't say that in a bad way, but sort of a formless kind of quality to it. And Ratcatcher is... So I didn't really know anything about this film. I knew it was Lynn Ramsey's first film. I've seen Morbrun Kallar, however you say it, my apologies, which is, I saw it a while ago, loved it when it came out. I probably saw it in the mid-2000s. We need to talk about Kevin is a challenging movie as well, a movie that is also sort of, I don't want to say it's formless because it's very much about sort of there's a parental arc there. And I have not seen You Were Never Really There or Never Really Here. My apologies.
Yeah. I really wanted to see that too.
It was amazing.
Yeah. I've only seen We Need to Talk About Kevin. It's the only Lynn Ramsey movie I've seen.
And as a parent, how does that movie speak to you?
Well, I mean, it's so funny because Laura was talking to me today about a friend we have who's a psychologist and does a lot of work with high school kids. And the headline is Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid. And, you know, sure. I just think that they were a little bit on the, you know, the leading edge of this. I mean, I had this, you know, crazy fucking flash today. I missed the exit to drop my kids off because I was thinking about this. And this kind of relates to We Need to Talk About Kevin. When I went to camp, Phil, I don't know about your camp.
Yeah.
Esther, did you go to camp?
No.
We had riflery at our camp. Did you have riflery?
We had archery.
So we had riflery. And, you know, in the 90s, we had riflery. And, you know, you'd lay on mattresses and shoot at targets, like, in the confines of the camp.
Sure.
And no one ever thought that was dangerous or weird or anything. Yeah. No one even thought twice about it. Occasionally there'd be a kid who was not allowed to do it. You did have to like have a special sign off to do it, but everyone did. And we shot guns and we were really fucking good at it. And it occurred to me that like they don't do it anymore. They haven't for about 20 years, but there would be kids now who would think about stealing those guns. I'm
for sure.
No one ever even thought about it, but I'm 100% sure people would think about it now. Right. Cause the guns were just left at the range. In a safe or not a safe in like a, you know, fucking
a locked cabinet.
And the bullets were elsewhere, but like it would be pretty easy to massacre everybody at the camp.
So
which is to say
we need to talk about Kevin, it was archery. Like he is an archer.
Right.
And
you're
we
right.
need to talk about Kevin. He's not a gunman.
Yeah.
Which I think is just an interesting.
I think that she, that Lynn has, and I I don't remember if they're what, in Morvern, is it Morvern? God damn it.
Morvern,
yeah.
Ratcatcher, We Need to Talk About Kevin, and You Were Never Really Here are movies about violence in some way. You know, Ratcatcher, I found very viscerally, I don't know that violence is the right word that I would describe it, but those fucking kids, those boys reminded me of
sexual violence.
Yes, right? They reminded me of the
violence. I mean, it is literally about violence. I mean, it's about he kills the kid at the beginning. Like, it's about, you know, it's about whether accidental or intentional or like the childlike sort of version of violence where there's that like mid ground of is this like play? Is this. You know,
physical abuse in some way or another.
Yeah. I mean, it's well, like, the, I guess it's like that child thing of like, is this play? Is this
right.
something that's, is this something that's intentional? Is this something that is sort of malevolent or is it sort of just this hormonal stuff getting out of control? And I think it's the whole movie is very fuzzy on that because it's also, I mean, also violence against animals, essentially.
Yeah.
Not essentially,
literally. Yeah. It's,
yeah.
it's very interesting how I agree with everything you're saying, Esther. This entire movie exists in that sort of formative space of like, you're not, some of these kids are a little older, they're teenagers, but you know, 11, 12 years old, where you don't really understand the world around you fully, but you comprehend certain things being bad or certain things being like that. There's a darkness that you don't completely understand yet. And there's a lot of like, you know, sexual adolescence, sort of a puberty kind of thing going on. And these kids that are sort of this poor girl that's being essentially like passed around through all these boys. And as they all sort of try to figure out and experiment sexually, it's all very unsettling.
I mean, the one-to-one kind of transition from Halloween to this is a horror movie. This is a horror movie about kind of growing up impoverished, unsupervised, without any kind of sense of right or wrong, with bad role models. When they're there, usually absent. It's interesting. It's told from the perspective of this young boy. So you are, you know, the perspective you're in, and, you know, kind of written in, not kind of written and directed by a female filmmaker. So you're, the perspective you're in, particularly during that, like essentially like this group rape scene, is the scene of this young boy who is kind of being urged to join in. And that is like this, you know, from his perspective, a horror moment. We don't see it from her perspective. It's pretty obviously a different kind of horrific moment. And, you know, a nightmare, but the sense you get is this is not the first time she's been in that position. So there are a lot of, I mean, it, the animal abuse is, you know, to me, a horror, but just this, like this, you know, this group, this mob mentality thing about, you know, kind of throwing rats against the wall or mice against the wall. It's a, like, it is, it's a really kind of galling film, deeply upsetting. I did bring up, we talked briefly about this before. I did bring up like Harmony Korine. I think the only American director that I can think of that kind of is down to, you know, kind of pull up this particular, you know, carpet and see what kind of disgustingness is on under it. But clearly, you know, we've seen this, and now we, you know, also Rosetta. There a lot of films we've done, Warzone, a lot of films we've done recently, European films have shown this might be, you know, something your European directors are a little more apt to expose.
It's
at least
really
in 99.
Sort of, yes, no, for sure. I agree with everything you're saying. It's very harrowing, to say the least. And yet at the same time, there are sort of punches of levity is the wrong word, but sort of
beauty, really.
Beauty, yeah. And
like, well, it's this idea of escape, I think, that she sort of plays with, you know, the magic of him like tumbling in the field in this, you know, where it in front of this like model home where his family could possibly move to out of like the Glaswegian slums, essentially, you know, overrun with garbage from the garbage strike. And he, you know, that moment of him tumbling, it's, you know, or snowball, you know, the following snowball up to a place where Snowball is not dead, but frolicking on the moon with other mice, you know, this escape, or even the end, you know, where you don't, is he drowning? Did he move to this new home? I mean, I think he's drowning. But I think, you know, she really does interplay it with all these things. I mean, I don't know. I have a, you know, interesting, I mean, I don't know, it's not interesting, but like my relationship to Lynn Ramsey is essentially, I find we need to talk about Kevin as this thing that like lingered in my head. I truly like have a heart, like I'm not sure I've ever seen it all the way through. Like I have a really hard time watching it. It's a really, you know, even before I ever tried to watch it, like it was a thing that like freaked me out on the concept of it. I watched more Vern Sklar. And I loved it. Like that, I think that's my favorite of her films. I think it's really beautiful, and it is, you know, her one film from the female perspective, though it is also so grim and so sort of grief driven.
Samantha Morton, unbelievable in that movie.
Incredible. I mean, I love Samantha Morton. And yeah, she's just amazing in that movie. And so I'd wanted to see Ratcatcher, and I actually had tickets to see it at the New Beverly when I lived in LA briefly. And then I'm pretty sure I didn't go because it was like one of the COVID flare-ups.
Sure. I remember looking at your tweets, your brief jaunt in Los Angeles, and how much you loved living here. I remember just watching that journey unfurl through social media.
What was wrong with LA? What was wrong with LA? It's a beautiful place.
My dog was almost killed. Dunzo was shining.
Oh no.
I literally had a nightmare about the LA coyotes last night.
Oh my god, where were you living?
Yeah, where were you?
The LA coyotes.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm not afraid of the coyotes. I'm afraid of that mountain lion that hangs out.
Yeah, I'd be afraid of the mountain lion.
P22.
Yeah, I love P22. But
everybody loves P22 until he bites you. Until he claws your face off.
Yeah, and it's so funny. Yeah, P22. Meant to see it, and then I just never got around to it, and so I was really excited to watch it for this because it was one of those, you know, I need to check it off. I'd seen all the other ones, and I need to check it off. Well, not we need to talk about Kevin all the way through. I don't think I'm really that movie really like obsessed me. But all of her movies really upset me. But I think that one really upsets me.
But I do think that Ratcatcher, you know, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, it's been on our list for 5 years. Yeah. It's been sitting there, and it's a film that is spoken so highly of. I mean, obviously, Lynn Ramsey is a, you know, a critically adored filmmaker. But I also was like, it was sitting there. I was like, it's Lynn Ramsey. This is not going to be a fun ride. Like, you know, got to get the right person to talk about it, but also just really not knowing anything about it, but only knowing that Lynn Ramsey's movies can be hard watches. I sort of had it sitting there, but knowing that it was going to be powerful, and it is very powerful. I don't, you know, it's not a movie I would ever watch again. and I don't say that negatively. There are lots of wonderful films that I've seen that I'm just like, I've seen it. I'm glad I saw it. But I'm also sort of fascinated by the fact that just give a little bit of context. James is 12 years old. The world he knew is changing. Haunted by a secret, he's become a stranger in his own family. He's drawn to the canal where he creates a world of his own. He finds an awkward tenderness with Margaret Ann, a vulnerable 14-year-old expressing a need for love in all the wrong ways, and befriends Kenny, who possesses an unusual innocence in spite of the harsh surroundings. Ratcatcher opened at the Cannes Film Festival on May 13th, 1999. It would be released throughout the world in late 99 and early 2000. It would go on to make just shy of $1 million. It's got 86% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 86% from audiences. The New York Times said it was a gorgeous blend of beauty and squalor packed with imagery that will play over and over in your head for weeks. Time Magazine said Ratcatcher sears. It's hard to take, hard to shake. And the LA Times said Lynn Ramsey's imaginative shot-making gifts make for a sublime result, creating a different sort of magical realism than we're used to seeing. I also need to say I've never turned on subtitles faster. This thing was like, are they speaking English? Like,
what I really, truly, I weirdly don't like watching movies with subtitles. Yeah. I know there are people that, you know, put it on for everything. If it's in English, if it's in a language that I understand, I truly sort of don't enjoy. Yeah. But this one, I was like, oh, I have to put on subtitles here. I
it was amazing.
Know, this the Glasgow accent is something that is very thick.
Well, there were moments when I'd be reading the subtitles and I'd be like, how is that possibly the same word?
Yeah, no, I'm with you, Esther. If my preference is definitely no subtitles.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, outer UK movies we've been doing with their crazy ass accents. Mm-hmm. We went right for it.
Yeah, same right with Warzone. I mean, that was another one. That
Warzone went right for it. Yeah, no, Warzone. I had to. Yeah. What are you gonna do? But I was thinking. I mean, this one is so difficult that I don't think I would have enjoyed the theatrical experience because there would have been no subtitles.
They actually did have subtitles in the U.S. release.
Oh, they did subtitles for real
in theaters. Yeah.
No way. Wow, that almost makes me sad. I don't know why.
Well, it's like you sort of wish it wasn't, but
I just think that whoever the U.S. distributor was just like, this movie's gonna make $10 to begin with. Do we want to make this harder or do we want to make this easier for people to actually see?
I almost feel like it's like opera, you know? It's not about the words, it's about the emotions. Who cares if you can't understand it? The truth is, without subtitles, I think we would pick up more than enough that we would understand what was going on.
Well, I think it's, I mean, I think the sort of, the dialogue is so incidental, you know, in some ways. It's very much, it's not like people are explaining any part of the plot, really, through dialogue. It is, you know, how people are sort of, it's just how people are going about their day, you know. That's how that functions. So it's not like, I think you're right, Kenny. It's not like you need it per se, but I was like, oh my God, I can't, like, this feels discordant in my brain. Like, I can't figure this out. Like, I'm like,
But it's also a very, it's a very melodious and emphatic language, right? Like the Glaswegian English accent, and you know what I mean. No, but the way that they're
Glaswegian,
spinning the language, for lack of a better way of putting it, is actually really beautiful. And I agree with you that if I didn't have subtitles, it would probably, like, I'd turn something off in my brain to allow myself to just kind of go along with it. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I did turn the subtitles on, and there were many words in the subtitles too, where I was like, that's not a word. Like, that's, that's okay.
Yeah. That's not, many non-words. It's true.
But I did find it, when the movie allowed itself to be sort of dreamlike, it is a really beautiful film. I do think about, some of the really beautiful moments between James and, forgive me, was it Margaret Ann? Yeah, Margaret Ann, you know, when they're just lying together and just sort of their love story, not a romantic one necessarily, but just that bond that they have is really beautiful. You know, you caught this, Esther, on Twitter earlier, but the Something Stupid sequence with the two parents, with the dad and mom dancing, there's a really lovely connection between those two characters, and there is a romance between them. He's just either shit-faced or, you know, a dick most of the time. But I do think that there is some really beautiful kind of, as you mentioned, Esther, escapes from this, quite frankly, horrible world that they live in. But I want to talk for a second about the boys, because I thought about the Droogs from Clockwork Orange with those kids, because those kids just seemed really, really evil. And what was interesting was seeing we only see the older kids briefly, but like, it feels like it's almost like, generational is the wrong word, but that, you know, the older you get, the kind of worse these kids got, and you're sort of feeling it roll down the ages a little bit. It's very upsetting. Really, really.
It's no different. It's no different than gang initiations. It's no different than the Droogs. It's no different. I think the Droogs are, you know, clearly an extreme version of this, but this is a thing everywhere. Yeah. You know, this is kind of what toxic masculinity is, right? Toxic masculinity isn't really one toxic guy. It's more, you know, toxicity feeding on itself, and, you know, people pushing, you know, guys, boys pushing each other to be, you know, kind of worse and worse and more callous, and treat women and women, you know, more and more like objects or sex objects in this case, and, you know, kind of force younger boys to do things that they don't really want to kind of solidify their place within this male hierarchy. So yeah, it is both droog-like and also, you know, extremely common. Like, it feels very much like situations that I feel like I found myself in and run away from, or found myself in and started to cry, or whatever it is. Just situations where, as you're growing up as a boy, you're like, you kind of can't avoid, and it's very hard to kind of extricate yourself from.
Well, it's like, I mean, and that's sort of the nightmare of James's existence, is that, like, the paths for him are, you know, sort of being initiated into this sort of, you know, adolescent world, or his father, who is, you know, who is a drunk and doesn't really care and sort of flits in and out of his home. And
pretty hot, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's the dude from Braveheart. He's like a hot boy.
Yeah. He's got that, like,
the scar. Great scar.
Yeah, he's got that incredible scar. But yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, this is the future, and the future is like miserable. Yeah.
It's the other filmmaker that I thought of as I was watching this was Lars von Trier. Mm-hmm. A guy who also can go with these, a beautiful filmmaker when he chooses to be, gives you these pops and these punches of beauty when he's not just beating you down with how horrible the world is. But what made me kind of think of that a little bit was The Canal, and how sort of vital it is to the story, but also how the depiction of it changes from time to time. You'll have this really beautiful scene, like the scene with Kenny and James, when they're sort of standing by the canal, and it's really blue, and you're seeing the sun shining, and like, it just feels really inviting and filled with possibility. And then at other times, it's just this muddy, fucking awful, monochromatic sort of death spiral that exists. Oh, yeah. It's also a really interesting physical.
It's the thing that sort of like sucks you in. I mean, it is the sort of, it's the life that, you know, it's the potential for life. You can either sort of avoid getting sort of drawn into its toe. I mean, and it's almost interesting because it doesn't seem so, I mean, it doesn't seem that deep. It doesn't seem that hard. Like, but, you know, the kid at the beginning dies, Kenny almost dies, you know, when his father emerges out of it, he's filled with so much muck, and like, they're scratching at the skin because it's been so, you know, it doesn't seem that deep, it doesn't seem that threatening, but it is, it, like, the pull of it is so weighty, it will kill you.
Well, it's interesting because, like, nature is so beautiful in this film, and also it's death. Do you know what I mean? Like, it is both. It exists in both these ways. I mean, it's funny you brought up Rosetta earlier, Kenny, because I couldn't help but think about that too, because that small body of water in that film also almost kills people.
Oh yeah, very important. Weird that, you know, I mean, bizarre that both these movies were canned at the same time, and they went with Rosetta over this movie. But
I think this was in, if I'm not mistaken, on a certain regard. I don't think they were in
competition. Yeah,
Was in competition because we just looked this up. We did Rosetta like 2 weeks ago, but it's the other movie. I mean, the other, first of all, as it's coming back to me, you said George Washington right away. I forgot George Washington kind of hinges on the death of a child too, which is, you know, obviously a big part of that. The other guy who's doing this now really well is Sean Baker. And Sean Baker's giving a lot of this similar kind of thing. Uh-huh. Florida Project is a lot like this in, you know, these little flights of escape and, you know, this kind of unrelenting bleakness and this little sense that maybe Mooney got out, but she didn't actually get out. And,
yeah, you know, the ending is very similar.
It feels very similar.
I mean, Florida Project feels a little bit more optimistic at the end. But again, to your point, the system is the system and Mooney's probably trapped in it in some way or another. So I don't mean to suggest that it's a happy ending. But
Baker's also funnier.
Like, I was going to say, he is funnier. I do agree with you, though, Kenny, that like Sean Baker is trying to sort of tap into
some of the, certainly the class issue, the poverty lines and the system and all that sort of stuff definitely seems to exist prominently in his work.
Yeah,
that I agree. It is fascinating that this and Rosetta are both a can at the same time, because I do think that they have somewhat similar ideas, but excuse me, I do wonder whether or not, did you like this more or less than Rosetta, Kenny, out of curiosity?
Me?
Yeah.
Far more.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
It's not even close. Yeah. I think this is a far better movie.
Yeah. This movie is, what's interesting though, for what it's worth, not that I disagree with you because I enjoyed it more too, but like, you know, Rosetta is a character piece, right? Like, not to compare a movie that Esther hasn't seen.
Esther, have you seen Rosetta?
She's not seen Rosetta. But I'll just say that Rosetta has this sort of...
It's like this, but really boring.
It's a lot less happens. and it's also visually a lot less striking and a lot less interesting. But what's the thing about Ratcatcher, for what it's worth, is I don't know that James, as a character, that I could tell you much about him per se. Do you know what I mean? Does that make
that
sense?
Was a big takeaway for me too, actually. I only wrote down a couple of notes, but one was that James was a bit of a cipher in so many of these movies, that, you know, these coming of age movies, particularly about young male characters, the main character is very often this boring cipher. Like another movie, it's a Lars von Trier movie that I'm thinking of, My Life as a Dog, is a movie where, you know,
My Life as a Dog is ours.
No, is it Lasse Hallström?
That's Lasse Hallström.
That's Lasse Hallström. So it's that character reminds me a lot of this character in that he doesn't really actually do a lot. He doesn't have a lot of, you know, I mean, a lot of action.
Correct.
But he just kind of carries the story on his, you know, like side saddle almost. And that's kind of how I feel about James here, where the story kind of rides side saddle to him experiencing things around him.
It's sort of interesting too on that level that she begins with this other boy who you sort of believe is going to be the protagonist.
Yeah.
The first moments are not with James. It's the other boy watching James skipping rocks from Ryan Quinn, I believe, skipping rocks from afar. And she, you know, she sort of
nice
leads
Jewish
you to
boy.
I agree with you. It's like it's a weird sort of red herring almost that she thinks you're going to be following.
Yeah, and it's and then sort of to get at what you were saying, Kenny, like it's this misdirect that, you know, James's whole existence is sort of accidental. I mean, that what he does, you know, Ryan's death is accidental. You know, his shame, that shame that he's carrying, is accidental. Sort of like all these things, even something that he is responsible for, is not his fault in a way. So he's sort of existing on this outskirts of responsibility, sort of the way. And, you know, it is so specific to that age too, where what is intentional, what is not intentional, what is malevolent, what just sort of like exists.
No, for sure. I mean, you can see it in so many of their actions. I mean, it really is throughout the entire film, but like if you think about the mouse whose name I'm forgetting his name,
Snowball.
Sure. Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Pour one out.
When Snowball, is put on the Snowball Kenny balloon and sent to the moon, in a weird way.
For those who haven't seen this movie, there's a red balloon with the name Kenny written on it. Correct. You can't imagine the way that spoke to me. Imagine a red balloon with your name written on it. That's how it felt.
It is an amazing moment, but it's also like it's called back to it at Kenny's. End when Kenny says, "Oh, look," Kenny is talking to James. He's like, "Look at the moon, hey Snowball," and James is like, "Fucking Snowball's dead, and you killed him." Like, I don't know what you like, and on some level,
it's like actually how he says it too, which is really. It's like, I was going to say, I'm a huge sucker for movies that let kids curse and that it's not a gag. Yeah. Like, I mean, that Seth Rogen movie was like the gag, Bad Kids or Good Kids or whatever it was called. The gag was that they, Good Boys was the gag was that they cursed. But like every child I know curses and like, it's not the fucking end all be all of their life. So I'm very into that.
But yeah, I mean, the thing with where he's, and Kenny is this kid who, not Kenny, who's call right
Kenny,
now.
Nybar,
Kenny, yes. the Kenny character, the yeah. Kenny, the little boy is this kid who, he starts out being, I'm going to create a zoo. I'm a member of sort of the animal organization.
Yeah.
I love these animals. And he doesn't want the other kids to play with Snowball. And then they let him. And then they sort of convince him into saying that Snowball can fly. And he ties him to this balloon. And I think there is this moment of, he's really convinced that, this dumb kid is really convinced that like maybe Snowball's off somewhere, but obviously Snowball is very dead. But it's this then you see him by the end,
a pretty bad death,
probably not a great death.
Poor Snowball. Mm-hmm. But then you see him by the end, killing rats, killing the rats, and even James is like, isn't this, weren't you a member of this organ, like of the animal?
It's like the RSPCA.
No, these are vermin.
The Royal Society.
Yeah. I guess that's what it is.
No,
these are vermin, and this sort of this thing that's clicked in this kid's head where he's chosen, violence against creatures versus his love for all beings.
Also, it's kind of a throwaway, but at the very end, near the very end, Kenny is calling James out on killing Ryan.
Yeah, he says, and he's like, also
I saw you. Yeah.
And he's saying, I'm not your friend anymore. I'm not your friend. You killed Ryan.
Man, the journey Kenny goes on in this episode, in this movie.
Yeah. And he's such like, doesn't he repeat it over and over again? Yes. You killed Ryan Quinn. Yeah. You killed Ryan Quinn. I'm not your friend anymore. And then a lot of fuck you.
It's very funny.
This movie's great. There's a version of watching this movie for the 40th time where you just laugh the whole movie.
I'm sure that's true.
There
is a version where, because there are moments in it, it's a very strange tone that it's sort of threading throughout. I think about the scene I don't even really know how you describe them, but the people that come to the house to check out the house to see if they can get a new house.
Yeah. That's...
And the dad's like covered in fucking cereal and dirt from the canal. And he just was like, it's just like, there's a version where.
And they're like, did we come at a bad time?
Yeah. And he's like, no, I was just getting up. I'm totally fine. And then him saying to the kid, like, if we don't get a new house, it's your fault for letting them in here. Like, there's just stuff where James is this emotional punching bag for so many people. There's also the lice. Like, there's a lot of animal stuff in this, but it's all like rats and lice and dead dogs and just like it's all a very kind of grim.
Have a lot. There's the animal stuff in Kevin too.
Sure.
I think she's very attuned to how sort of preying on the vulnerable makes us feel. I think that's the truth in You Were Never Really Here too, which is sort of, you know, which is centered around Joaquin Phoenix's character rescuing this child, essentially, from this young girl from sex slavery. You know, I think she very much draws you into this feeling of, you know, sort of empathy and also discomfort for sort of the most downtrodden creature and the most vulnerable and the most scared. I mean, even the sort of slow motion shot of the, you know, of poor Snowball being tossed back and forth between these guys, these, you know, the older bullies, it's really hard to watch. And I think she's aware of that. And she is,
I think she understands our affinity for animals too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think she knows that seeing these animals in, you know, peril is going to elicit an emotion from the audience as well. And I know, I don't mean that she's wielding it, but I do think that she understands it.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, even just that moment when James is in the foreground and in the background, we see all the piles of garbage and we see some teenager pick up like a dead German Shepherd dog or something like that.
Yeah.
Kind of like, it's blurry and out of focus, but you're just like, there's something so upsetting about just the level of kind of squalor they're living in. And it's interesting too, because I feel like, you know, to talk about another movie from a around this region, but like Angela's Ashes, a movie we talked about many, many moons ago for this podcast, is all about sort of, you know, poverty porn, for lack of a better way of putting it, and sort of that like Oscar Beatty kind of.
There's no porn in this one.
No.
No.
Whereas that movie feels, I mean, that movie had like an $80 million budget. I mean, it's exactly the Oscar Beatty, yeah, overproduced kind of version of squalor.
Yeah, it's like fucking Oliver Twist. It's like, yeah. It's this, you know, these not practical sets, you know what I mean? These like, well, these well-lit, almost like Broadway-ish idea of what it is to be a poor person. And, you know,
it's slick almost,
and how, you know? And how easy it is to rise up, you know, if you're a genius memoirist.
Sure.
But and then even, you know, even Rosetta, I think we kind of,
yeah,
you know, dinged a little bit with the idea of poverty porn.
Yeah.
This is just bleak. This is the dead animals really is, you know, kind of dissuade you of any notion
romanticization of it.
Yeah. Anything, yeah, other than the worst possible fucking situation to have human beings live in. It's really a nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, the filmmaker I often think about sort of in conjunction with Linda Ramsey, and it's partially because they're both from the UK and sort of working around the same time. And not that it's not because they're both women, but is Andrea Arnold, who I think sort of, you know, and I think she does. Andrea Arnold has not a romanticization necessarily, but a romantic, though I think you can maybe argue that American Honey is a romance, but like, it like has more of a romantic heart to her. She's very interested in the carnal, in a way that Lynn Ramsey is not. But I think a lot about Fish Tank. I'm not sure if you guys have seen Fish Tank.
No.
I mean, it's also sort of a UK, I mean, there's an easy comparison, but it's a UK housing product, but it is from a girl's perspective, and an older girl. But it's basically about this girl who's, you know, mother brings home her shitty new boyfriend, who's played by Michael Fassbender, who's like the most alluring man in the world, but also a piece of shit.
Isn't that Michael Fassbender in a nutshell?
But I think a lot about just sort of the way, you know, they also both like playing with the fantasy of it, you know, pegged against this harsh realism. Love Fish Tank. I think that movie is amazing.
I think that, you know, this movie is not
particularly romantic outside of perhaps the something stupid scene. It's, I think if it's romantic about anything, it's that we're all gonna die. Like, if there's a romance of death, almost, there's a romance of like, to some degree, nature. I mean, I think about that you alluded to it earlier, but there's a sequence in the film where James gets on a bus and goes to the end of the line and discovers these beautiful houses, or these houses in the middle of construction, pees in the toilet unattached to anything, which is a choice. And then there's just this just truly gorgeous shot of this big open window overlooking what looks like an endless ocean of wheat, I guess it's wheat. And he literally jumps out the window and just starts running in this beautiful ocean of wheat. And it is unquestionably the most beautiful part of this film, which goes to show that, like, she can do this. If she wants to, she can make you believe that the world's a beautiful place. She's just not really interested.
Reminds me of, the shot of him running, it's like the Wizard of Oz poppy fields. It's like, it's hypnotic, and you get lost, you get lost in it, and you sort of, it's the fantasy world. And then he goes back to that house shortly before the end of the movie, looking for that experience, and it's raining. And he can't get into the house, and it's raining, and so he can't have the fantasy of living in the house, and he can't have the fantasy of tossing through the fields. And that's when it cuts to him face down in the water, and you're wondering whether or not he's dead. And then one more time cuts back to his family walking through those wheat fields, maybe moving into that house, him standing outside of that, but you sort of are... That is not the case.
They're all way too happy.
There's a
placid, sort of beautiful look on the father's face, and you have this moment where James looks right at the camera, very similar to the end of Knights of Cabiria or Magnolia, or even to some degree Rosetta, where like you have this, it's all going to be okay. But then as the credits play, we're back in the water and he's drowning, and you're just like, I don't think he really buys into this at all.
No, I don't think she does.
So, it is interesting. I mean, the other thing that's worth talking about for a quick second is when the dad saves Kenny from the canal, he becomes sort of a local hero briefly. There's like a medal ceremony
where he's the only grown-up getting a medal with a bunch of little kids in this fucking movie. See, this movie is hilarious. This is a funny movie.
And then he gets the award, and the first thing he says to his family is, I'm going to the bar to meet my friends. I'll see you guys later.
And then he gets beat up on the way home from the bar.
Yeah. I mean, this movie.
I can't believe he got a medal. Eddie stood up there next to all these kids who saved, I guess, newts or something. Helped ladies cross streets. I don't know. You get medals as a child.
It's incredible.
Up there like he accomplished something. I mean, really great.
It's really pretty special. I feel like
that's how my kids feel when I tell them I have a podcast.
going to the pub to meet his friends.
No, not going to the pub. Like, I'm standing on the stage with a bunch of kids. You know, it's like it's like, oh, you want us to be proud of you for this, Dad?
Bully for
okay,
you.
Okay, great podcast. Great job, Dad.
Yeah. I mean, I will say though that I really liked this film, despite the fact that it wasn't a fun journey. It makes me want to see You Were Never Really Here. But I hear that one's also pretty tough to watch. Yeah.
I mean, I like. This and Morvern are my favorite of her films. Okay. I mean, Morvern is definitely my favorite of her films.
I feel like I read somewhere recently that she's talking to Kristen Stewart, which sounds right.
Yeah. I mean, she's had such an interesting path in like Hollywood, because she made We Were Never Really Here, and then she was on this Western with Natalie Portman that got,
it was a famous kind of
famous sort of disaster production. Yeah. And she was taken off of it. And then she sort of came back with You Were Never Really Here.
Right.
Which was incredibly, you know, lauded. And, but that is, I mean, that's, that movie is so violent because it's really violent. It's more violent in a way than, we need to talk about Kevin because you were never really here. We need to talk about getting lost in my head.
And now complete sentences, titles. I'm okay with yeah. it. I like she a complete also, sentence for a title.
We talked about her a little bit, Kenny, previously because she almost made The Lovely Bones.
Forgot about that.
So yeah. She was attached to that.
Could you imagine?
Can you imagine?
Probably a better movie.
Definitely a better movie.
Definitely a better movie. Definitely a more fucked up movie.
Yes.
Well, I mean, yeah. The subject matter. I don't know. It's like, is there a world where someone could have made a Gone Girl esque masterpiece out of Lovely Bones? Does Lovely Bones lend itself to something where the right director could have actually made something amazing out of it?
I mean, the question.
My sense is maybe.
Maybe. I mean, I haven't read the book. Have you read the book, Esther? Did you read Lovely Bones?
No, I never read Lovely Bones.
So when we did our episode on our 2009 Patreon, one of our guests had read the book. And the movie that was made is pretty slavish, for all intents and purposes, to the source material. The question, I think, ultimately, Kenny, and I agree with you, is I don't think there's a quote unquote pure adaptation of that book that could be done adroitly. Like I don't know that you can, because like the book is, you know, it's not plot wise.
I have a weird take.
Okay. Okay.
Someone should do it again. Why not?
No, they can't. The author of that book is minor. Oh,
she's canceled. Yeah, she's a bad person.
Whatever.
No, she. The book,
didn't she maybe make up a sexual assault?
No, she didn't. She was assaulted, which formed her first book, but she wrongly accused a black man of the assault, who was, I believe, imprisoned for many years.
Not a great look.
And
that being said, you know me, to divorce the art from the artist. I don't care. Sure. Maybe just hypothetically, because I'm not going to be the one to do this.
Yeah,
but we should not remake movies or books that have been, you know, failure, misfire situations. We do it every once in a while. You know, look, God love Rob Zombie, but Rob Zombie did his Halloween reboot, and 5 years later, they just turned it right back over to David Gordon Green.
And then he did the Munsters, and everyone loves the Munsters.
And everyone's happy. But I wonder if...
No.
40-year-old man, Esther. Come on.
I don't know. I feel like some people
four watch kids. You can barely watch the movies.
I'm kidding. If Tom Lorenzo heard me say that, he'd flip out on me. He's so mad on me. We're brothers and zombie. I feel like there are some movies, for instance, The Strangers is about to get remade, right? That movie is only from like 15 years ago.
And there were a bunch of like straight to video sequels to it as well, right?
Yeah. So you can certainly do that. There have certainly been more than one movie made off of several novels. It happens all the time, right? Yeah. Often they wait like 70 years, like Wuthering Heights or whatever. But
and often
there's no reason
like
when
unimpeachable classic,
like a Little Women
novels, yeah.
Well, like a Little Women or whatever, but
not the airport book du jour.
But that's what I like about it is I like that it's the airport book, and that's what I'm looking for. I think because they already made, as you said, Phil, the slavishly devoted version. You know, I think a deconstruction with a Moreland Ramsey-esque director that maybe, you know, doesn't make the main character just, you know, some weird conduit for how, you know, it's cool to die as a child, might be might be
it's
interesting.
Cool to die as a child. That was the tagline, right?
dying as a child is cool. Oh no, it's only the cool die, yo.
Oh my god!
Yeah, that movie's obviously ridiculous, crazy. But I do think that there.
Yes, what's that clip? You know, yes, the like yes, Oscar yes, clip Twitter yes, account yes. Oh, yes. Of yeah, Stanley Tucci. Yeah.
It is chef's kiss. He literally says it's so bad. Like you can see if you read his lips, he's just like, "Why did I get nominated for this?"
I would. You know what? I'm gonna try to get the rights. I just decided. Don't you think if this got announced on Deadline tomorrow that FX is putting in development an 8-episode Lovely Bones miniseries, people would be like, worst idea ever? Or,
well,
dot,
I,
dot,
think
dot,
I ultimately think film Twitter would basically be the book is great, the movie sucks. Yeah, sure, go for it. See if someone can do something better.
Wait, does film Twitter like the book? I feel like we just had a film Twitter member be like, airport book.
I don't know. I mean, my whole thing with The Lovely Bones for Lynn Ramsey in particular, because, and I don't know about you, Esther, but when they announced Lovely Bones back in whenever it was, my brain immediately went to, oh, he's doing Heavenly Creatures, right? Like, Heavenly Creatures.
Well,
was...
I hadn't seen Heavenly Creatures yet. I was okay. Very,
but point was... my point still stands, which is I think that ultimately a lot of people were like, oh, this makes sense, subject matter wise, what have you. Had Lynn done it, and if I remember correctly, Kenny, in our Lovely Bones episode, we talk about the specifics of her take, but I believe that her take had a lot, basically was never going to go to heaven for all intents and purposes. Like, we weren't going to do any sort of like any of that bullshit.
That would never have flied back then, but it would fly now. Is kind of what I'm getting at.
So
it would be interesting. It would be interesting to have my reboot. By the way, my reboot is like getting made like Dancer in the Dark style. No, like Dogville style.
Dog,
right?
So like I want that. I want this movie.
I want this movie made for under $50,000, and I want all handheld cameras.
Who is this for?
It's for me. No. I'm kidding. But like, I just think like, strip down everything, because the weirdest thing about the Lovely Bones, because I never read the book. All I knew was that it was a phenomenon. Peter Jackson is the director. I hadn't seen Heavenly Creatures. This is 2005, 2006, 2007 when it gets announced. I thought that was so crazy that this guy who had only spent $200 million on his last four movies that were all, you know, big blockbusters and everyone, you know, he won Oscars and all that thing, was taking on this movie about, you know, bones, about a cool dead chick. And then people were like,
Ben Hosley's favorite movie, Bones.
Buried. People were like, no, you have to understand, like this movie actually is very VFX heavy, and they're all these like crazy worlds, and you do need like this visionary kind of, you know, director to pull it off. I'm like, okay, I don't know. And then I never saw it until we did it for our podcast. Yep. And it's one of the 10 worst movies we've had to watch.
It's definitely one of the worst films we've seen. You've seen The Lovely Bones, I'm assuming, Esther. I mean, Tucci's performance alone, I mean, is really something to behold. I mean, it is.
It's just like one of the weirdest casts to Wahlberg. Like
Wahlberg. But Saoirse somehow gets out of it, you know.
Always does.
She's great. She's always great. Yeah. Let's rate this, because Esther, we want to hear your top 10 of 1999. So we're very
excited. Brought it, Esther. I love it.
I brought it, but also, you know, you told me about this the night before, so it's just like, this is a rough, you know, rough.
We're not gonna hold you to it. But so like I mentioned, I had never seen this film before. None of us had, so there's that. I came into this at an 80 on this movie. I'm going up to an 84. I think it's a really, really good movie. I don't see myself buying the Criterion and watching this again in the future necessarily. She's a very powerful filmmaker, and I wish she had more movies. I think it's kind of crazy she's only made four films. I know that she probably, it seems like, you know, was it Janie Got a Gun? Is that the name of the Western?
Yeah, Janie Got a Gun, something like, yeah.
And
I know that she got mired in that for a while. And like, I know that she's had, as is the case, I imagine, with filmmakers like this, hard to get films up on their feet, you know, hard to get funding, hard to do all those things. But she, I can't wait to see what she does. So that's where I'm at. Where are you at, Esther? What do you think?
Oh, I'm so bad at rating things. I mean, I'm probably around there. Like I you know, I hate number. I hate numbers.
No stars, no numbers for us.
No stars, no numbers. I'd say probably like between 85 and 90. I think it's an amazing film. Like
it's a really it is funny. So you've only been on this podcast once before for Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, what a ride. What a ride.
You contain multitudes, Esther, is really what it comes down to. Obviously not, you can't compare the two things, but I do think it is, I do think it's fascinating.
Do whatever you want. It's our podcast.
That's true too. All right, Kenny, where are you at?
I gave it an 84 before the podcast. I'm going to go up just a little bit because it is a little more, it's obviously very bleak, but this conversation wasn't very bleak. So it's not the kind of movie like when we did Warzone, we just sat here like, you know, virtually hugging each other through like what we had to experience.
Have you seen Warzone? Esther?
I've never seen Warzone.
It's Tim Roth's
movie. You just Google it and you'll see what it's about. And you'll also want to kind of get a nice digital hug. Ratcatcher, like, look, it's terrible in many ways, but it's also, you know, it's really, you know, kind of low key charming. And, you know, I totally buy these people and I buy their world. And I, you know, I think it's horrific in many ways and also beautiful in many ways. I'm going to go all the way up to like an 89. An excellent film.
I think that this is the type of movie that, considering the kind of sandbox we have done of like UK or international kind of grim movies, I would agree with you that this is at the top of the pile of that. Like, I think that it breaks out of that kind of box. So anyway,
well, we've done some really incredible international movies.
We have.
But not really incredible UK movies. I do think this is the best. That's this is the best UK movie we've done, but
we know, so, you know,
Top Survey stinks. That's true. But, you know, we've done,
it is one of your hottest takes, Kenny. And I love it.
Topsy Turvy is a movie that my parents took me to see in theaters when I was when I was 9 years old. So real fucking weird relationship.
So as a 9 year old, did it speak to you?
No.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, so it was like, oh, you know, deep, like Gilbert and Sullivan, you know, like,
yeah. We don't need to relitigate Topsy Turvy, but I'll just say this. I agree with you that we've done a lot of international films. I look forward to us talking about that when we wrap up the whole thing. You and I will sort of.
Because we'll have to do all 26 categories, I guess.
Pretty much.
So we will have to do a best international feature. And
I mean, I'd be hard pressed. You know, I think Audition's going to be on both of our lists, I imagine. But
I mean,
Esther, yeah,
okay. Yeah.
Audition certainly on the list, but look, Audition Girl on the Bridge, but also
are you going like,
we'll Oscar it?
You're Oscaring it. That was the verbiage I was looking for.
Well, I mean, Princess Mononoke is an international feature that we did. True. Rosetta is an international feature that we did. You know, there are ones I feel like, you know, when Daniel Waters and Mike Natale came on, there are some ones that we're not going to do The Dream Life of Angels, which apparently people think is amazing. So
yeah,
what are you going to do? You can't hit them all.
So
here's the question. Do Canadian features count for best international feature?
I am going to say yes.
What? Wait, then UK movies count too.
Dude, Canadian films are in best international, are they not? Do they not put themselves into that category?
They do.
Sometimes
only if they are French language or First Nation language. So it really has to do with the language.
Which seems arbitrary to me, but sure. It doesn't have to do with the border and the fact that it's another country?
Bro, I don't know. I mean, have you ever seen an Australian film in best international feature?
Have you ever seen it? It wasn't an international feature until like 2 years ago.
It was foreign language film.
You're right. Foreign language is a distinction.
Because I have seen a Canadian film in there. I believe there has been a Canadian film in first language in First Nations language before.
Right.
So it's possible. But I mean, am I going to put Last Night on that international feature? I feel like we're talking a foreign language here.
Let's hear your top 10.
Okay.
Any foreign language movies in there?
Giving us a chance to chime in. Just 10 movies.
I didn't rank. I just came up with 10 movies.
Okay. 10 movies
that are my favorites from 1999.
Great.
Election.
Killer.
Notting Hill.
Yes.
One of the best. First person we've had do this.
You're the first one to put Notting Hill on.
Wow. Rude.
It was on my original top 10 list. It may make it again at the end. Not sure.
Eyes Wide Shut.
I think that's been on everyone's list.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Dick.
Yes. Dick.
Yes.
Love to see this.
Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah.
Also been on everybody's list.
Yeah, that's in everyone's. Magnolia. That's in everyone's list.
Yep.
Holy Smoke.
Cool.
That's
all
a
right.
bold pick. That's a bold
I really
choice.
Like that movie.
Yeah, we do too.
And then to swerve completely, Toy Story 2.
Yes.
No, that one gets on a lot of lists too.
Yeah,
that,
I just like having them next to each other.
Sure.
Being John Malkovich.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And The Limey.
Yes.
It's a great list.
That's my list.
That's a great list. I mean, The Limey.
No topsy turvy, nothing to be embarrassed by with that list.
Obviously nothing to be embarrassed. That, you know, The Limey, a great episode, a great movie that I feel, I don't know, like people talk about it in the 99 kind of, if you expand your 99 list.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's on a lot of top 10s, which is
well, there are so many. I mean, I don't know. There's obviously stuff that I like that I kept off for a more interesting list.
Sure.
You know? Sure. I was about to put on one movie that I haven't seen in a really long time that I forgot came out in 1999 until I was, maybe it didn't actually come out in 1999. It was released in January, I guess. It was a British, this British movie, Still Crazy, with Bill Nye as like an ex-rocker. It's really fun. It was on like some, it was probably released in like January, but not sure if it counts type of thing.
It might have got a limited at the end of 98 type thing.
And
yeah. Like a cusp movie. I was looking at the
whole list. So have you done every major release from 1999 now?
Oh yeah.
We have or we will. I mean, we haven't done Magnolia on purpose. We haven't done Big Daddy yet. We have a few that are, you know, that have been saved, but
American movie. I love
Big Daddy. I think Big Daddy is so fun.
Griffin's coming on for Big Daddy.
So I love Big Daddy. I think Big Daddy is really funny.
Well, I love Sandler like deeply in my heart. But yeah, look, we're doing Ratcatcher with you right now. Look how far.
No, this is how far you've done. But yeah. Oh shit. I have to delete something off my list. Because I was just looking at it again. I have
What do you need to add to your list?
I need to add Galaxy Quest to my list.
It's amazing how Galaxy Quest has popped up on almost every list.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot it was 1999. I have to delete it. I'm going to delete being John Malkovich and add Galaxy
Quest. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a big deletion.
It's
a serious deletion.
Yeah. That's
I love
crazy.
The Dick remains, being John Malkovich gone.
Yeah.
You didn't put The Matrix on your list.
It's true.
No, but I was just, but that's because everyone's been put on their list. True. I don't know. That was like a. That's like a same with like
you don't have to. Yeah,
you know, those are movies that I like.
Yeah,
but you know, I've watched Galaxy Quest a million times.
Hey, Galaxy Quest is a great film. Nothing wrong with Galaxy Quest.
I think it's also interesting too that there are some 99 films that people are like, this is such an obvious 99 pick, I'm just not going to go there to some degree.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And I think Matrix and Fight Club fall into that category for some people.
Well, you know what? You know what's on nobody's list, Phil?
Mm.
That I'm a little surprised by, but maybe it's just the, you know, the people we have on our pod. No one has had Sixth Sense.
That's true. Ooh. A great movie.
A great movie.
And people love M. Night now. And it almost feels like it's gone back to underrated a little bit, you know?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Like anybody, yeah, I don't know.
It's now, not my favorite now I, of I his think, movies.
What is your favorite?
It's not your favorite.
Unbreakable.
I think that has become
the consensus a more, choice.
Yeah.
Just a more common take than it ever was. You know, the last like 4 or 5 years, I hear Unbreakable a lot. And I almost think people have forgotten just how perfect Sixth Sense is.
I think
granted that, we weren't that nice to it on our episode.
We weren't
overly nice to it, but like,
has
I
anyone
feel just
put in, the Phantom in, Menace on?
No,
we would have canceled the entire episode.
No one's put that on there, but we've had like Blair Witch has popped up.
Well, yeah, that makes sense.
Which is a great.
No
movie.
One's put like an actively bad movie yet, as far as I can tell.
Well, I mean, if it depends on Mike Natale's list was filled with 99.
Oh, yeah, he's a wild man. And Cogman put Dobbs Disturbing number one. But aside from that, yeah, Natale, our friend Mike Natale is a wild man. He put a 3-minute paint on film.
Yeah, like a fucking a British fuck. I mean, just absolutely insane. Like just stuff you're just like
at number yeah at number 5.
Yeah, it was like it was high. It was crazy.
Yeah,
but I do think that you know 99. They're the bangers. They're the ones that people just you know need to put on there. And then there's I mean even just
you
like
can't, the thing yeah. is you can't have your list be like all of the bangers. So you have to delete some of the bangers. So it's like okay, I'm gonna have like Eyes Wide Shut and Talented Mr. Ripley and Magnolia on as my bangers, but you can't have entirely bangers.
I totally agree with you, and in fact I'm gonna read you something. So we have a guest coming, we have Daniel Waters coming on to talk about Open Your Eyes in a few weeks, and he sent his top 10 list, which is fascinating because some of them I've never even heard of. And when I said them to you, Kenny, as well, there's those who love me can take the train. I've never even heard of this movie. I don't know what
I never heard of that. That's his number one, right?
He's got The Matrix and he's got Insider and Election, but then he's got Janine and the Perfect Guy. I don't know what that movie is. I've never even heard of that movie. He's got the Iron Giant, Man on the Moon.
You know what? We should not include. We should not.
It's fine. I'm not too worried about it. But anyway.
No, I just want him to be able
to do it when he's on. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, of course.
All right. Well, he'll do it when he's on. Fine. I'm not.
Take that, Waters.
But listen, a great list, Esther.
Thank you.
And as always, we're so thankful to have you on. And
oh my God, thank you so much for having me back.
And I'm glad that we all found an opportunity to watch Ratcatcher.
Yeah, I'm really glad. It
really is a great movie. And I what can I say? We love your articles, we love your criticism and your tweets and your books. Are there anything that you want to plug? Your book, perhaps?
Yeah, buy my book, Beyond the Best Dressed. It's still in stores. It's in the Academy Museum gift shop. If you want
to,
if you visit there and want to pick it up there after seeing some of the dresses featured in the book on display, so that's fun. That's my big plug.
Have you been to the Academy Museum?
Yes, I did. It's so cool. I had a great I had an accidentally free day in LA when I was there last because the person I was supposed to interview had COVID. So I managed to get into the Academy Museum and I was just, you know, I was in LA by myself. So I just spent many, many hours there. It's hoping to go back soon and do some research in the library. So
it's an amazing, if you're in LA or if you're, you know, if you live in LA, if you're traveling in LA, I highly recommend going to the Academy Museum to see a movie. I've seen many movies there.
I want to see a movie at the screening room. It looks really cool.
They're really, it's a really special, thing that they built. And when you're there, you can buy a
So there you go.
Or you can win a fake Oscar like I did.
Yeah.
Or you can have a virtual reality moment where you win an Oscar. Yes. So that's that's pretty.
I won. It was pretty exciting. I got to tell you.
Well, Esther, thank you again so much for
coming. Thank you so much for having me back.
We'll talk soon.
Great to see you, Esther. Esther, take care.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.